love me, you see. No use in trying to settle down. I've traveled over this whole wide world. I'll give most anything a whirl. But woman, please stay away from me.
Woman, live life.
That was, what was that?
Woman, stay away from me.
By?
Some guy.
Some old guy who wanted to be stayed away from.
Some old guy. I'd have to look at the label. No, it's as you can hear, it's an old song.
Yes, the label that is right in front of you, that would be too much work.
So much reaching.
Fine.
To the thing.
He's probably dead anyway.
Well, maybe. You don't know.
I said probably.
Bonnie Guitar of Shanty Boat fame is still alive.
That's true.
Yeah.
That whole weird construct you came up with about her grandchildren still makes me chuckle.
It chuckles you?
Yes.
That's great. This is Linoleum Knife.
Yes, a podcast of the cinema.
I'm Dave White. I'm the film critic for Movies.com.
And I'm Alonzo Duralde, film critic for TheWrap.com and What the Flick.
And also noted homophobe. But yes. We'll get to that.
Yes, well.
We'll get to that in a minute when it's time to talk about your many crimes of hate.
Mm. Yes.
You've had so many hate crimes this week.
Mm-hmm. The Southern Poverty Law Center is after me.
You are a one-man hate group now. Thanks to the Southern Poverty Law Center. Thanks, Southern Poverty Law Center.
I'm still waiting for my invitation.
You're humble and lovable.
I'm still waiting for my invitation to CPAC.
Well, you're not their level yet.
Well,
you're getting there, though.
It's good to have goals.
You're getting there, though. Anyway, we'll table that discussion.
Okay.
Because it's too ugly a topic to start a lovely podcast with. All your dastardly ways.
And it does tie into a movie this week.
Well, yeah. Anyway. This is what you just said what this was.
Yes.
You just said it was a podcast of the cinema.
I did.
We said our names.
Yes.
And what else do we have to say before we start talking of the cinema?
I can't.
Let's talk about what a homophobe you are.
Oh, fine.
In relation to the new movie.
300.
300.
Rise of an Empire.
Rise of an Empire. Okay, so I'm going to lay this all out because I think it's very important. You don't get to talk anymore. Oh,
okay.
Fine. Because of your homophobia.
I wasn't homophobic last night.
I will be the judge of that and of this. All right, so you didn't see 300.
Correct.
I did. It was dumb. I enjoyed myself a reasonable amount. 300 has wrought many a film that looks just like 300.
Right.
And acts like 300. Now it has given birth to its own sequel.
Mm-hmm.
300 ROAE. Rise of an Empire.
Rise of an Empire Records.
And so you go and you review this new one for What the Flick.
Right, which I also did not see. So I didn't review it.
You introduced the clip on What the Flick.
Right.
Although, and you sat in on the review that Ben and
Matt and Christy.
And Christy.
Ben was sick.
Ben was sick, but threw in his
rating, yes.
His rating, okay. But you, for some reason, did not see it. Did you not see it?
For those unfamiliar.
Did you not see this one because You didn't see the first one?
For a number of reasons, but not having seen the first one was the main thing. If you don't know what we're talking about, I am on a review show called What the Flick.
We just mentioned that.
I know, but I got to explain what it is to people so they know what you're talking about.
All right.
In case anyone hasn't watched it.
Okay.
It's on the Young Turks Network on YouTube.
Yes.
And I review movies generally with Ben Mankiewicz of Turner Classic Movies, Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com, and Matt Achety of Rotten Tomatoes.
And if you look, if you tune in weekly, you get to see the progress of your forever upsizing beard.
Yes, maybe someone
just
will,
gets bigger.
Someone
and
will
bigger
do like some
grayer.
Stop motion animation.
No.
Anyway, so but sometimes we don't all see the movie, but since we're already sort of set up for lighting and microphones, the person who hasn't seen the movie will just sort of sit in and kind of watch while the other people talk about it. That was the case this week for 300.
Yes.
I didn't see it. Partially
so they
because
let
I hadn't
you introduce
seen the,
it.
Yeah, because I hadn't seen the first one, and also because long story. Anyway,
to
I didn't
give
see
you
it.
To give you something to do on that episode,
mm-hmm.
they let you introduce it.
Correct.
And here is how you introduced it. Welcome to What the Flick. I did not see the first 300. Too faggy for me. You said faggy.
Yes.
Number one, you said faggy.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, you called 300 too faggy
mm-hmm.
for you.
Mm-hmm.
Just inherently hilarious.
Because there's nothing on earth that is too faggy.
This is you. Right, I'm going to tell you. Listen, here's what he did about a week ago.
Oh, boy. What is this going to be?
In the shower. I'm in the kitchen doing dishes or making something delicious for dinner for you, probably is what I was doing. Something amazing. Also, maybe some toast for myself. No, I wasn't doing the dishes because you always announced to me
yes, that's
that
right.
you were going into the shower.
Because when you do dishes and I'm in the shower...
It ruins the cold water or hot water. Or so, I don't know what it does to you, but...
It gets freezing.
You would pitch a conniption spazzy fit when I know when that happens. Yeah. Whatever it is that's happening...
Yeah. I'll dump a bucket of ice on you
in
next time you're
in
the shower.
Mind.
See how you like it.
Whatever's going on in your mind, yeah. So anyway, I hear singing coming from the shower... and the song goes a little like this. Don't something something life's something and the sun's a ball of butter. Something something clouds and rain on my parade. I don't know the words.
Really?
Yeah.
You were covering it up so well. Who would have guessed that you didn't know the words?
And then you sang the second verse, to which you also know the words. You sang even the part about being juicy, which is somewhere in the middle. Isn't there something about being juicy in the middle of that song?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. She announces Barbara Streisand.
No, life is juicy.
Oh, fun,
not,
well, whatever.
Not that she's
juicy. She's juicy. I think it's she is juicy.
Juicy's got you crazy.
So you were singing about being juicy in the shower and having people rain on your parade. Do you know who does that?
Faggy people.
Faggy people. So
that was the context of that joke.
Yeah, clearly, as a homo man who sings Don't Rain on My Parade in the shower, for you to get on What the Flick and call 300 faggy is inherently funny. It is a joke. First of all, because it's you. Secondly, it's also a joke that has been told so many times by so many other people.
Yeah, like when Sarah Silverman said the title means, how
on
gay
scale,
is this
on a scale of 1 to 10? Yeah. And so, and then what was so great about that moment is that YouTube, of all places, YouTube list commenters
who have been happily calling me a fat faggot for however many years that I've been on What the Flick
are now up in arms. They are outraged and offended by your little, you know, ironic bit of humor. And someone even called you out on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who did not know who you were. Or
who did not take the 15 seconds to Google my name.
who you've been kissing. Name's me.
The name of my first book.
The name of your first book.
Anything.
Or the fact that you sang...
Don't Rain on My Parade
about being juicy in the shower. So that's what's going on this
Maybe
week.
Maybe I'll learn the Ballad of Lucy and Jesse from Folly so I can do another song about being juicy.
I think that you need to say that the anti-gay F word everywhere you go. Just because
it bothers people.
It bothers people and it's hilarious coming out of your mouth. What I really even love more about this is that there's a moment in my book where I called someone that name because he was being a jerk. This guy was being a jerk to me,
right,
and I called him that name. And you, in real life, scolded me for a very long time.
Well, okay, whoa. This is a very different thing.
Hang on.
You yelled out the window to a guy... In the next car,
he was
eat-ish faggots. You yelled that to an individual.
He deserved it.
And you
all in my do defense, not
look if people can
in my defense he was being one.
If people can watch What the Flick and not immediately pick up on the fact that I too am one gay, like the guy on Twitter, I had to explain it to him. He was like, "Oh, I had no idea,"
right?
Because I'm a mask bro.
You are.
There,
the pheromones of masculinity.
The guy
they erupt off of you.
The
like
guy
a
to
Vesuvius
whom you,
of Pompeii.
The guy to whom you yelled "eat ish faggot" while you were no doubt wearing a black metal T-shirt and scowling,
maybe
probably didn't pick up on the nuances of your being a gay wife.
It's like I told Kevin and Bean that day that I was on their show and they were giving me a hard time. Those people don't know enough gays. All kinds of gays.
I would say...
I'm the kind of gay that looks like me, talks like me, mm-hmm. walks like me, wears the T-shirts I wear.
Right.
That's what kind of gay I am.
Yeah, well...
There's a bunch of us out there.
I'm sure
there are. We are our own special...
But you know what?
...little club of gays.
I bet in a Pepsi challenge where you were mixed in with straight bros who wear metal T-shirts and scowls...
I would be called out as the gay.
Nope.
Yeah.
Not unless a tea service came out.
That would be great.
Or a selection of scented candles.
That would also be
or
great.
Or if they started playing Kylie Minogue on the loudspeaker.
Even better.
Without those trappings, you do not come off as a gay wad, even though you are a total gay wad. You committed a hate crime against that one guy. I was being ironic, thinking that obviously anybody could tell that when this one opens his mouth, there's at least one purse coming out. But apparently not. Apparently not.
I think that when you open your mouth, what comes out is a superiority complex. And not necessarily a purse. Maybe.
What about a Fendi bag? A Birkin.
A weathered professor book bag of snootified... snootified sarcasm. Maybe. I don't know that I would call it a purse.
So that's been my week.
Anyway, so this is all about 300.
Right, yes, R-O-A-E.
Which has had most of its hilarious and unintentional homoeroticism stripped away.
Uh-huh.
I think they went to the first film and said, okay, what was gay about this? Like, we're racking our brains. What was so gay about 300? They say it was so gay. We don't know.
I don't see it.
We don't see it. Let's call in some experts. So they call in some experts. And people are like, yeah, well, that was gay. That nude wrestling, that's gay. All those...
The guy with the jewelry covered in gold.
The digital torsos. Fairly gay. Now they got rid of almost everything except for the manscaping.
Uh-huh.
Like here you've got the manscaping and one wrestling scene. And Xerxes. You've got him played by Rodrigo Santoro.
Right.
Unrecognizable, by the way.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure he likes it that way.
His eyeliner and his mankini and his facial bejewelment and his cape, sparkly cape. Mm. He's the one on the giant billboard that says, "Athens will burn!" You know him. And then you've got the Greek bros,
right.
The Spartan-ish guys.
Themistocles, or as Christy Lemire thought he was named, the Mysticles.
Yeah.
So,
you got him and all his buddies, and here's what's unusual about their bodies. This is the gay thing about this movie.
Mm-hmm.
They've all got really, really current trending beards.
Hmm. Like sculpted, like...
No.
Oh, they're not using the Andre 3000, that thing is?
No, it's either like major scruff.
Oh, they've got Brooklyn beards.
Or full on, like mega beards. Like whatever the dude can grow, they just let it fly.
They're Mumford and Sons.
Yeah.
Okay.
They're you, essentially.
Wow, yeah. I should be pointing fingers, I suppose.
However, no matter what the guy has on his face,
mm-hmm.
chest shavedy, waxy clean.
Everything below the clavicle.
Everything, yeah. Neck down, they are like a baby's bottom. All the better to see that definition.
Yeah.
And it's weird.
Because if you're cut, like, you know, why hide that?
You've got like this big, giant beard, and you're like, I'm sorry, what's going on the chest? Nothing? That doesn't make sense. That doesn't scan at all.
Waxing salons of ancient Greece.
Yeah. So so that's weird, and it's, you know, I'm watching the movie going, all right, beard, 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 smooth, 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 smooth. Like, I don't understand.
Like, there's not one sort of token hirsute dude?
The Persians.
Oh, but...
They're not shirtless, they're just wearing, they've got all their, like...
Armor
battle stuff on.
Gotcha.
You know. But the,
The Greeks are just wearing, like, straps.
Yeah, right? And you know how unhairy the Greeks are.
Of course.
So, here's one way, I'll tell you, you know, here's one thing that hanging out with lots of bears in the world of gays,
yes.
Here's one thing it teaches you. You can have a giant beard.
And
still be completely smooth, all the rest of you, but it is not likely.
Not every single one of
them. Not every single one of them, yeah. So here's the movie. The actual movie. Xerxes and Artemisia, played by Eva Green,
mm-hmm.
who, by the way, is fantastic.
Well, I hear it's her movie.
In this film. The whole movie is about her, and when it's not about her, you're looking at your phone being like, who can I text to tell how boring this movie is? Then you've got the guy from Strike Back, Australian.
Stapleton Starkweather Sullivan, or something?
Sullivan Stapleton, okay. Who is made of meat. He's the lead Greek. He's the king of the boss. He's the boss fighter guy of all the Greeks. He's
made of delicious bologna meat.
Now, Xerxes is just kind of hangs out in his cape and, you know, makes pronouncements about.
Swans about.
Yeah. But the Artemisia, Eva Green,
mm-hmm.
she lays it down. She stalks around the screen. She's got these long nails. She's just like like running her fingers on something.
Right.
Big giant 2-foot-long dagger stabs an apple, puts it in her mouth, cutting chunks of it off with this gigantic dagger, chopping off her enemies' heads, seriously decapitating people, and then making out with their severed heads. It's really, really,
wow,
really good. She's excellent.
Well, I hear her hate F scene with Sullivan
is Stapleton. Fine. It's fine.
Okay, because
yeah,
Vulture made it sound like one for the ages.
Yeah, well, that's because people think that any sex in movies now is a revelation. So if it's weird sex on any level, then suddenly it's one for the ages.
Gotcha.
It's not. It's fine. You know, the fact that she shows her breasts, I think, is actually sort of like the weird, you know, revelatory moment. Because she's not a nobody.
Right. Exactly. Not enough famous people are doing
that. And she doesn't care. Like, you know, she read that script and saw what was going on at the beginning of the shoot and was like, oh, I could own this whole movie. I think I will. And she does.
Yeah.
Good for her, because it's about 50% of the time. She's on screen about 50% of the time. That's nice. That's a mm-hmm. good amount.
Yeah.
But boy, when she is not, then you've got to look at these Greek dudes and be like, oh yeah, you're supposed to be the good guys that I'm rooting for. When in reality, all you want is to watch her just get it. You want her to kill the hell out of everybody. Because she grew up real hard. Like, you're watching her backstory in the movie. This is the Greco-Persian Wars, by the way. You could Google that if you want. Wikipedia, they will tell you things about it. It was a historical thing. Although this movie has no history.
I was about to say, I'm sure it's not exactly.
There's no history going on in this movie.
Bullfinch here.
Her character, just parents slaughtered. She's repeatedly raped and tortured as a kid. Mm. You know, she has her reasons for wanting to kill everybody. And so when you're kind of feeling her, you know, like about two-thirds of the movie, halfway through the movie, you're thinking, all right, I'm happy if she wins. Just get them all. Just
maybe
kill all the guys.
Maybe this will be her Taken, and we'll get a whole new genre of Eva Green is going to kill you.
Eva Green is going to kill you. Those would be films I would watch.
Mm.
Because she establishes herself in this film as the star of the movie. Sorry, Sullivan Stapleton. I'm sure you're very good on Strike Back, and you're quite handsome, but not enough. And she's the star of this film, and she also establishes herself as, you know, a powerful badass lady of the cinema.
Right.
So
now the only people who are back from the first film are Rodrigo Santoro and Lena Headey, right?
Yes.
So
and she's the one that says this is Sparta
uh-huh.
in the movie. But she says it in a way sort of like, are you kidding? This is Sparta. And the audience, the preview audience is like, hooray. Like, a little golf clap for her when she says
that. I mean,
that.
Does she stand up to, does she make nearly as much of an impact as Eva Green does?
No.
That's my question.
No.
Now, and this movie is taking place concurrently with the first movie?
I don't know.
Or something?
And I don't care.
Fair enough.
And the reason I don't care is because these movies don't matter.
Right.
They are accidental hits. And they...
And thanks to them, we have crazy Spartacus on stars now.
Unfortunately, these films are... They're aesthetically uninvolving.
Hmm.
I find them uninvolving because they play out like little video games. You know, they play out like little cartoons, and they're not. There are no stakes involved. There's no history. There's no. It wouldn't take much more effort to make them good. To crazy up the violence instead of stylizing it so much. Like right now, you know, anytime somebody gets stabbed, it's sort of like, oh, look at that digital brick brown reddish blood splurgement. You know, it's... there's no impact. The violence has no impact. The sex is cartoonish. It's camp for dummies. And that's not actual camp.
Right.
That's not camp at all. It's
just inept.
Technically it's ept, but it's dull.
Just not interesting.
They're dull. They're dull movies. I don't think they're beautiful to look at. Mm-hmm. I don't think they are interesting to look at. They're very, you know, they're 3D, but they're still very flat.
Hmm.
I'm not into them. I don't dislike them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel strongly about them in any direction. They don't leave any kind of impact at all. They just kind of slide right off when you're done watching them.
All right then.
If you're down for, you know, digitized musculature, fine. You know, go enjoy that, I guess.
Well, yeah. I mean, if people dug the first one, will they like this one?
Maybe. Look, if you go see it, I guess I'm saying that Eva Green is enough to see it for.
Okay.
She is so much fun that she takes what would have been a dirt dry nothing.
Right.
And makes it a half dry almost something.
Okay, then.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Linoleum Knife has a sponsor. Linoleum Knife brought to you by...
It's time for a commercial. Linoleum Knife is brought to you by The Real Truth. Everything you didn't know you need to know about making an independent film. Look.
You got it right this time.
I got it right this time. It's by Reed Martin. He's so great. You know what? I didn't know who he was until this morning. Didn't know what he looked like. Didn't know anything about him other than that he had a book.
Mm-hmm.
Listen to this.
What have you learned?
Reed Martin has taught a course on film marketing, distribution, and exhibition at NYU's Stern School of Business since 2003.
Yeah.
And he taught at Columbia Business School from 2001 to 2003. He recently worked as a research associate and caseworker in the Global Research Group at Harvard Business School. All right, so this guy is not a dummy.
No.
Martin is a graduate of the Management Trainee Program at 20th Century Fox Film International in Los Angeles, and he received an MBA from Columbia and a second master's in business reporting from Columbia's Graduate School of Journalism.
Well.
How you like Reed Martin now?
Ivy Leaguer.
Faber and Faber doesn't just award book contracts to any old fool who walks in off the street.
They didn't win it in a cereal box.
That's right. Reed Martin knows things about how you make a movie.
And how not to make a movie.
And how not to make a movie. So he wrote this book, this very big book. I'm going to tell you that it's the only book you need. Do you want to make a movie? Well, stop making it now, jerk. And take a break and read this book. Because if you don't, everything is going to be ruined.
You're
going to
make dumb rookie mistakes.
For example, maybe you're already making this mistake. Maybe you're using a phrase that you need to stop using on page 288. I'm going to tell you about it right now. This is a little preview of the book that you're going to buy and read from Faber and Faber for $25 retail.
Less on Amazon.
A phrase to stop using. Even when a producer comes up with the money to pay for a last-minute solve, the results can still be far from ideal. People should really... What?
What?
Oh, wait. Okay, wait. People should really say, we'll cheat it in post, because I don't think anything's ever necessarily fixed in post, says Matthew Libatique, cinematographer of Iron Man, Requiem for a Dream, and Pi, among others. So, yeah, don't think you can fix your mistakes.
So, wait, you just read that wrong. You're thinking, don't say, let's cheat it in post?
Don't say, let's fix it in post.
Let's fix it in post.
You can say you can cheat it in post.
Ah, I see.
But you know what'll happen to you when you cheat?
You will not prosper.
You will not prosper. You know what? Winners never cheat. Cheaters never win. That's what you can learn from reading Reed Martin's book, The Real Truth, R-E-E-L, like the reel of a film.
I will once again post a link to its Amazon page on our Linoleum Knife Facebook page.
Are you stupid? This book will make you not stupid about how to make a movie.
So get it.
I'm going to keep reading this book. And I'm going to keep reading little chunks to you so that you can understand how important it is that you own this book written by this dude, Reed Martin, whose credentials are impeccable.
Yes.
Better than Alonzo Duralde's, that's for sure.
True. Well, look, I never wrote a book telling anybody how to do anything.
His credentials
I don't know how to do anything.
Almost as good as mine.
Oh, yes.
Well, I'm a graduate of Texas Tech University.
In Lubbock.
So, yeah, he's our sponsor. He wrote a book. Maybe you don't want to make a movie. Maybe you don't care. Don't you want to know stuff anyway? Don't you want to learn things?
Don't you want to spot first-time mistakes?
Just because you're not going to the moon like an astronaut, does that mean you don't want to know about science? Well, think about that. He said, well, tossing said. The heavy 500-page book down on the table.
Moving on.
Thank you, Reed Barton, for writing a book.
and for sponsoring our program.
Yes.
Mr. Peabody and Sherman, speaking of science.
Apocryphal.
Yes. It has the word apocryphal in it.
This is a children's film.
Yes.
Where a child refutes the story of George Washington chopping down the cherry tree as apocryphal. And when Sherman says that in the film, my heart did a little dance. Because if I had been 7 and my mommy had taken me to see Mr. Peabody and Sherman, I would have turned to her and I would have said, what's apocryphal? And my mom would have said, I don't know. I think my mother died not knowing what the word apocryphal meant, but that's not important. I would have asked her, and then she would have said, we're going to look it up in the dictionary when we get home. Because we did have a dictionary.
Ah, good.
Yeah. And I would have been, I would have walked around for the next week trying to use the word apocryphal.
In a sentence.
In a sentence. Because that was one of my favorite things to do when I was a kid. Learning the vocabulary words in school, mm-hmm. and then using them.
Yes.
Also, learning the vocabulary words on my own from A, Peanuts, which was well over my head.
Oh, yeah.
And B, all other things on television and the movies. If someone said a word I didn't know, I would immediately start asking and trying to figure it out.
Yeah. I just remember getting...
To the dismay of the adults around me.
I remember when I was 12 and I was reading The Onion Field, I made the mistake of asking somebody, what does copulation mean? Live and learn. Anyway, Mr. Peabody and Sherman.
Who did you ask? Who'd you ask that word
of? One of my siblings, I think. They were like, look it up.
That is a Duralde family noise that you just made, by the way. I've heard almost everyone in your family make that noise.
Eventually, you will hear all of us make that noise.
Probably. So they didn't destroy Mr. Peabody and Sherman.
No, they didn't.
I was.
This is like a giant shock to me because I had nothing but dread going into this movie. Our friend David Zeev, just even though I told him it was good, refuses to see it because he's cranky about this sort of thing.
Right.
But no, it is smart and it's funny. It gets the premise of the original ones in terms of the sort of goofing on historical stuff and the puns, but. It does the thing that I hate when other movies do it, because the other movies do it badly, which is, all right, we have this great kid's book and 30-minute TV special on the Grinch. How do we turn it into a movie? Oh, I know. We'll give him a backstory and impose a three-act structure upon it.
Yes.
But we'll do it stupidly, and it'll be awful. In this movie, however...
They still do it.
I thought it worked. They actually take the idea of Mr. Peabody being Sherman's adoptive father seriously, and maybe a bit too seriously. Yeah. I mean, I could have admittedly done without the social worker who's trying to take Sherman out of his custody, but it didn't tip over into terrible for me. It was the least of the movie's virtues. But I actually cared about the father-son relationship between Mr. Peabody and Sherman. I was moved by it.
I don't need that, and nobody needs that.
But you know what? You have to have stakes, and part of the stakes of that is that the two of them, and it worked for me. In any event, this movie is wall-to-wall funny and smart, and it gives you words like apocryphal. It talks about how George Washington didn't really cut down the cherry tree, and Marie Antoinette didn't really say, let them eat cake. Even the poop jokes are funny in this movie.
There is actually the funniest poop joke I've ever seen in a kid's movie. And I've seen all the kids' movies, and I've heard all the kid movie poop jokes, because there's always at least one or 7 in any kid movie. This one has a poop joke. It's hilarious.
I don't know if it's my favorite. I think my favorite might still be. And did you ever see Flushed Away?
Yeah.
Remember, there's that mouse, the white mouse that talks about that when he eats curry, his underwear looks like the Japanese flag.
That's not funny.
I thought that was funny.
That's gross.
That's a visual joke. I thought it was funny.
It's gross. That's gross. This poop joke is also gross, but. So witty, anyway, I'm of two minds on this movie. It is very funny. I won't say it's wall-to-wall funny. You and Bibbs were falling out. You and Bibbs were, like, cackling.
I was amused.
I will tell you that someone we know after the film said to me, does everything amuse those two?
No, I've talked to... Yeah, oh, look, I had communication with critics. Critics who have been on this program.
Yes.
Who think I'm crazy for liking this movie. Who did not... They were not into it at all.
I think it's funny. I think it's smart. The sentimentality of it really sunk it for me. I don't think you need it, and I don't think... And what I really think it's about when they do this kind of thing is not for the sake of the film. It's for the sake of reinforcing a narrative for the audience. Because parents take their small children to see these kinds of films. And taking your kid to a movie is a hassle. I know this because, A, I have done it. Not my own children, but back in the early 90s, I was a volunteer at an AIDS hospice. And not a hospice, more like a residence.
Yeah.
I mean, it had hospice elements in it. But there were a lot of parents who lived there with their children. The parents had AIDS. And the kids did not, obviously. Every Saturday, I would take those kids to the movies. I would drive the volunteer.
I don't know, obviously, but yes, I know what you're saying.
Well, I mean, the kids did not have AIDS.
Okay.
None of them did. Okay. Anyway, it was in Dallas. They had a big 18-seater van. And I learned how to drive that 18-seater van. And all them kids.
Luckily, in Dallas, you never, ever have to parallel park.
No, you don't. Although I did have to parallel park that van sometimes.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. In the parking spaces at the residence.
Ah.
Yeah. I would drive those kids, about 12 of them, every Saturday afternoon to the big town mall. Now, long gone, the big town mall. Now, the big town mall, Dollar Theater. We would go see just anything. Let me tell you.
I saw Highway to Hell there. It was
taking
rotten experience.
Taking one or two kids to the movies is a hassle. Try taking 12 at a time.
No.
And, but where was I going with this? Oh, I'm sorry. You take your kid to the movie. It costs a lot of money. Mm-hmm. Your kid's acting up. There's no guarantee your kid's going to like the movie.
Right.
They might be rambunctious during the movie. You've wasted your money on a movie that the kid doesn't want. So what you need, at least something to grasp onto in a film, is for the film to reinforce the idea that, yes, you do, in fact, still love your child.
You know what? This movie...
And that's what this movie does. That's what they all do.
But I'll
tell
you...
They all do the thing of... That's why there's so many animated films now and films aimed ostensibly for children, aimed at children, ostensibly at children, that are actually about parents learning to be better parents.
Right.
Well, that's why that is in there.
I think it's also wish fulfillment for the kids. You know?
I don't think it has anything to do with the kids. I think it's about parents. I think this is the message that these movies are bringing to parents. Like, you need to be better and...
Turn off your laptop, pay attention.
And don't like, drive into the ocean with the minivan with the kids inside.
I'll tell you.
I just saw that on the news this week.
I would much...
Someone would drove into the ocean with a minivan.
It's much better handled in Mr. Peabody and Sherman than it is in, say, any Adam Sandler film.
All right, yes, true. But that's not the point.
Okay,
the
that's damning with faint praise. Yeah. I think, I don't know. Look, if you had told me going in that it was going to cover those subjects, I would have gone, eh. But in the actual execution, I thought it worked.
I'm more for this than I'm against it.
All right.
But the parts I'm against... Really bugged me.
Well, the parts you're against mostly didn't bother me, and in fact, I thought they actually worked. So, anyway, go see Mr. Peabody and Sherman.
Wait until it's on TV or whatever.
I would recommend it. I think it's you know what? It's showing at the Mission Tiki in a double feature with the Lego Movie.
Is it?
Yeah, that would be fun.
I don't think so. Here's why: too many kids.
They're in their cars.
No, they're not. Those kids are running around like maniacs at the drive-in. You've been to the drive-in
you're
enough.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, too many kids. And the Lego movie is too good-looking to watch at a drive-in. You don't go to the drive-in to see something and enjoy how it looks. Mm. The screen's not well-lit enough.
Actually, they put in new digital projectors at the Mission Tiki last year.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. The drive-in is not an experience of cinema. It is an experience of social behavior.
Well, okay, yeah. You don't see it the first time at the
drive-in. It's an experience of funnel cakes, carne asada, french fries. That's what it is.
And the train coming through every 20 minutes.
And drinking, sneaking in the booze.
I don't know what you're talking about.
And make it out if that's your thing.
Anyway, I like this movie more than you do. I wholeheartedly recommend it. Other big name movie this week in limited release, but
very
obviously
limited
expanding.
Release.
Yeah, four screens.
Yeah.
But doing crazy money on those four screens is Wes Anderson's The Grand Budapest Hotel.
Yes.
Which is, in a lot of ways, the ultimate Wes Anderson experience.
Yes.
You go down what somebody referred to as a rabbit hole of narration.
Because you do.
It starts out with a young woman visiting the graveside of an author.
And it just says author.
Yeah, and yeah. Pulling out a book called The Grand Budapest Hotel. We then cut to a late-in-life interview with that author, played by Tom Wilkinson, who says that that the story that he wrote in the book is entirely as it was told to him. Then we flash back to the author in the early 70s, as played by Jude Law, who is taking a rest cure at the Grand Budapest Hotel, which is a faded shadow of its former glory. You know, there's signs all over the place, and it's kind of ramshackle. And you can tell it was once a much grander facility, and it now has, you know, orange molded plastic chairs in the lobby. Mm-hmm. In that hotel, Jude Law,
which are still really great.
Yeah, well, of course. It's a Wes Anderson movie. Everything looks great.
Everything.
Jude Law makes the acquaintance of F. Murray Abraham, who tells him the story of his life and how he was once the lobby boy of the Grand Budapest Hotel during its pinnacle years between the wars. And then most of the movie is his flashback about being the lobby boy under the legendary concierge Monsieur Gustave. Or is it M. Gustave?
Monsieur Gustave.
Monsieur Gustave, played by Ralph Fiennes.
Because later on we get Monsieur Chuck.
Oh, right. So it's this kind of Valentine for, you know, the last gasp of kind of European foufara before...
Gracious living. Yeah.
Foufara. Before World War II. And it's a caper, and it's a mystery, or not a mystery exactly, but it's a farce, and it's a prison break,
it's a chase,
and it's all kinds of things, and it is an art director orgasm. The Grand Budapest Hotel is itself this sort of pink pastry box, and then the lobby boy falls in love with a baker played by Saoirse Ronan, who of course delivers all of these things in pink pastry boxes.
Not just pink pastry boxes. They are
elaborate,
elaborate boxes that open out.
Like you undo the ribbon and the sides fall. You know?
It's just, they're amazing.
And there's a scene where the two of them are inside the back of the truck, which is itself a little pink box,
right,
surrounded by pink boxes in front of the hotel, which is a pink. Anyway, my thing with this movie,
which is sort of a visual echo of the way the narrative sort of nests in one thing and then another. These are boxes in boxes in boxes.
What are those dolls called?
They're called nesting dolls.
Right, but they have in Russian, they're called Petrushka dolls.
Something like that.
Yeah, so it's that. My takeaway with this, and I need to see it again, because when I saw it, while I was watching it, I found it utterly exhilarating and exciting and just a filmmaker totally firing on all cylinders and doing what he does best, and it just was exciting to watch. It was breathtaking. And then 2 or 3 hours passed after it was over, and I forgot the whole thing.
Well, that means you just need to see it again.
Maybe, but it felt like this sort of ephemeral sugar rush, and then at some point I crashed and it was gone.
I do not see it that way. I really, I'm a huge fan of Wes Anderson, even the films that you don't like.
I say, yeah, you're more of a fan than I am. And yeah, I
like Darjeeling, you know, yeah, everything like
that. The films of his that I like a lot. But yeah, Darjeeling and Life Aquatic do not work for me.
I really think of this one as, well, I compared in my review on movies.com, which for some reason has not posted yet. I'm not sure why. A little cranky about this, but not, you know. Nothing I can do about it.
Nope.
And so, the...
let go, let Joe.
Ray Fiennes' character, Mr. Gustav, is very much like other Wes Anderson heroes. Specifically, for me, very much like Max Fisher. In that... he constructs his own reality based on the indulgence of his personal eccentricities. So he has this little world that I know this is a word that we're all trying to stop using now, but that he curates basically. And
he's also like Bill Murray in Rushmore, though, in that he's this sort of father figure mentor the lobby boy.
Yes, but
to Zero.
But he wouldn't be if he weren't the kind of person who has successfully willed his eccentricities into life,
right,
and made the world into the way he wants it to be. Mm. And then come the Nazis.
Right,
they're not Nazis here; they're called Zigzags, which is. I really feel is appropriate for this movie because it's kind of it's a memory and it's about how time softens things. Mm. And particularly if you're the kind of person who is sort of an aesthete and doesn't want the ugliness of the world to enter.
Those brown shirts.
You build up your own wall. And the world may crush in on you anyway. It does to him.
Right.
But through it all, he maintains his sense of self.
Right.
You know, when he finally gets himself broken out of prison after they toss him in prison, the first thing he wants is his lait de panache, his men's fragrance.
Right.
It's a man's musk fragrance that comes in a beautiful box. Mm-hmm. Just like the pastries, just like the hotel, it comes in a beautiful box. It's got an atomizer, so you have to squeeze it under yourself. And very much like, and I've talked about this before on the show, Deanna Vreeland's DV, where she talks about how her own relationship to fragrance is that she likes to just bathe in it. Mm-hmm. And her my favorite quote in the book is, "I shouldn't have to sniff you like a hound to know what you're wearing." And the film very explicitly says that you could smell Monsieur Gustav coming because of the lair de panache. If he had been a real person, I think Deanna Vreeland would have known him. I betcha. She was acquainted with Stefan Zweig. Mm. I bet you she was, at least at some point in her life. You know, she was a young woman when he was already an adult, but something tells me they may have crossed paths because her view, her way of looking at the world reminded me a lot of him.
Did you read that David Thompson negative review of this film?
I did not.
Because the Stefan Zweig thing apparently is what he really found sort of offensive, because Zweig actually sort of, you know, survived the Holocaust and you know, like, had a more complicated relationship with the world than the sort of pink glossy fantasy.
Okay, well, but this isn't a biopic. No, of Stefan Zweig.
But it's
based on the spirit of his writings.
Right.
This is a guy.
He's still being cited in the footnotes.
All right, so, you know. Sure, but that's not about. It's not about his life.
No,
it's about a guy who. Let's say it's about a guy who took his cues from Zweig's writings. Mm-hmm. How's that? You know,
i.e. Wes Anderson.
Yeah, and so I really like the idea that things that other people might find silly or ridiculous or inessential or inconsequential become what keeps you strong inside. Right. You know, like these little towers of macaron or or this bottle of perfume, you know, this is your weird little symbol of resistance.
Right.
And I really love that. I love that about Wes Anderson. I love that about his heroes, who are weird people who get dirtied up by the world and it hurts them, but they don't stop because they can't because they're obsessive. And I know as a filmmaker, he's the same way.
Right.
If he weren't, his films wouldn't look the way they do. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't have the kind of dialogue they have. They wouldn't not move the way they don't move. You know, all the shots are like these static, meticulously composed shots.
Yeah.
He lives in a world of artifice.
And whenever he moves the camera, it's always in a very sort of like geometric kind
yes.
of way.
He lives in, even people, even characters, even actors' movements on screen are that way. When Saoirse Ronan pops her head up out of a hole in the film, and she quickly turns her head to one right angle and then quickly turns her head to another right angle.
Right.
I thought, well, she's Wes Anderson acting. Like, that's what you do. These are...
And the clipped deadpan that everybody
yes,
does.
These are... This is a highly artificial world of obsessives. Right. And that's who this director is. And anytime a director figures out a way to work the system to get his way, precisely his way. Three cheers for that dude, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when we had Matt Seitz on the show a couple weeks ago who wrote the Wes Anderson collection, you know, we talked about how Bottle Rocket demonstrated some compromise with sort of notes or whatever, right. But pretty much everything since then, you know, he's really gotten his own way and really gotten to sort of see his vision through.
Yeah.
No, so, I mean, I believe, like I said, this is in a way, I mean, with the possible exception of Fantastic Mr. Fox, I think this is the purest Wes Anderson vision,
yeah.
you know, yet.
And it may make people angry.
Yeah, yeah. If you don't like him, you'll really not like this, you know.
Even though I
found it kind of, you know, like I said, even though it zipped out of my head, I recommend it for the experience. You know, it's people often will talk about movies being, you know, like a roller coaster or whatever. This movie, actually, I do kind of liken to an amusement park attraction in that while it's happening, it's thrilling. And then you get out and you're like, kind of, wow. And then, you know, then you go get a funnel cake, you know.
No, you don't give it the credit for being as substantive as it is. It is substantive. Mm-hmm. It is not, I said this also in my review, it is not style over substance. It's style as substance.
No, I get that.
And it is, you know, it's a world where sorrow enters, and there is sadness, but there is a resilience on the part of the people involved. And it's very moving.
I'm not saying the film doesn't have content. I'm just saying that it doesn't linger. At least that was my experience. But like I said, I will see it again.
Yes.
And if I get more of a lasting thing out of it, then bully for that. But if not, even if I don't, or even if that doesn't happen, I still recommend it for the experience of actually seeing it.
Yeah. So. We agree that I'm right.
No, never. Also this week, which you did not see, lucky you, The Face of Love.
I give you the face of love all the time.
So is your face of love.
Look at me right now. Look at me right now. You see this face?
Listeners, I wish you could see this face of love.
Face of love.
Such a face.
And it's burning a hole through you.
The punim of love.
Face of love.
Okay, so it stars Annette Bening, and she is married to Ed Harris, who is an architect, and he has built her this gorgeous little L.A., you know, jewel box where, like, the entire back wall of the house is windows and there's a little lap pool in the backyard and everything.
And then he dies in a boating accident with Timothy Hutton.
No.
And then
no.
they recover him.
No.
And she takes his face
no.
and cuts it off no. and sews it on to another guy. so that that guy, the new guy, has the face of love.
That's actually a better movie. I like that pitch. No, okay, so he does die. He dies. They're on vacation in Mexico.
Well, what do they do? How do they get his face sewn onto the new guy?
There's no sewing of faces.
I thought that's what
happened. No, and she doesn't decapitate anybody and make out with their head either. So he dies.
I wish the movies would just be the way I want them to be.
Yes, well, sadly, we got to press on. They're in Mexico. He is drunk and a little buzzed, a little high, and he goes swimming in the riptides and dies. She is distraught. Years pass, and she feels his presence all the time and thinks she sees him and thinks...
Was he a ghost?
No, but she's just, you know, it's...
All right, fine. Keep going.
This is the best part of the movie, actually, is the way that his presence is felt in her life as a widow.
All right.
Then one day, her daughter points out that she never goes to LACMA anymore. That, you know, she used to always go there.
Well, it's always crowded.
Yeah, it is.
It's really crowded there a lot, and, you know, people are, it's noisy.
Yeah.
You can't go into the big shows without people being noisy and kind of getting in your way.
Yeah.
Like, the James Turrell show is great.
I still need to go.
Because that's happening, and you get a timed ticket.
Right.
So that each room just you. Is not just you, but it's... You and a few other people.
I see.
Yeah.
LACMA, by the way, is the L.A. County Museum of Art.
No.
So one day she goes, and sitting on a bench under a tree is...
His face.
Well, his face on a body. Like, it's a guy who looks...
On the body of a goat.
No. Guy who looks exactly like Ed Harris, played by Ed Harris. Go figure. And she's just sort of wigged out by it and kind of like sort of follows him and tries to figure out where his... car is.
Figure out how they sewed the face onto that other
exactly,
guy.
Exactly, right. And no such luck. She misses. He leaves. So she starts going to the museum every day. Like, sitting on the bench, sitting near the bench, like, just waiting for the guy to come back. And one day he does, and she follows him. And she figures out that he is a professor at Occidental College. He teaches a painting class.
Right.
And so she pretends like she wants him to become her tutor for private painting lessons, and immediately they
private
lessons, and so immediately they become a couple, and she lies and says that her husband left her, which is, I guess, technically true,
to the grave.
Exactly. He left me and this mortal coil, and not the band. But then there's this whole thing where she's got to keep the relationship secret from...
I would have you know that this Mortal Coil is not an official band.
Oh.
That it's a group collaborative effort on the part of multiple artists of the 4AD label. And not necessarily a band on its own right.
Thank you, show off.
In its own right. I just didn't want you to be embarrassed in public.
Oh, and being corrected by you was not embarrassing?
I would hate that for you.
Yes. Oh, you're so considerate. Anyway, so then it becomes this whole stupid thing where, like...
When you die, I promise I'm going to have your face sewn onto some new hot guy.
And why would he agree to that?
Well, he'll have me. So, obviously... He'll want to do anything he can to please me.
I am being cremated, face included.
No. I'm going to have your face saved.
No.
Like on that scene in Spartacus when they chop the guy's face off. I'm going to get Spartacus to come and be like, face chop time.
I've been watching...
Save the face
I've been
of my
watching,
love.
I've been watching too much Hannibal lately. You're not saving anything. It's too gross. Ugh. Anyway... So then it just becomes this whole stupid thing where she's got to keep the relationship secret from her daughter and from her neighbor, Robin Williams, who's been sort of hitting on her because it's, you know, because she realizes how crazy it is that she's dating this guy who's a dead ringer for her late husband.
That's not problematic.
And she's keeping a secret. She's keeping the whole dead husband thing secret from Ed Harris because she thinks once he discovers that he looks just like him that, you know, he'll question the relationship, which he should. And it gets a lot less interesting. And then the movie is such a sort of like a lifestyle design catalog because, you know, the first husband's an architect and he's a painter and she like stages homes for sale, like to make them look lived in. And so it's all this sort of like talk about...
She puts dirty dishes in the sink and stuff.
Exactly, yeah. Today I'm going to sell this house. Yeah, that's another problem. When you have her...
You've got the lady from American Beauty...
Working in real estate.
Humping Pollock.
Yeah, exactly. You've got Pollock in the painting. And yeah, just all this talk about, oh, is that an Edward Ruscha? You know, it's
who's got an Ed Ruscha in their house?
She does, because the architect had been an art collector.
Smart art collector. Yeah. From back in the day, art collector, yeah. Too.
Well, you know, Ed Harris has been around. Yeah. So, yeah, it just, the stuff where she sort of feels his presence and thinks about him all the time is really well done and a really nice sort of like, okay, yeah, I could see where that's what maybe being a widow would be like and why that would be sort of upsetting and at the same time kind of gratifying or whatever. But then it just gets stupid and you don't care about it. And it finally builds up to this
then
big...
Then comes the face-off.
This big phony climax where the two of them go to Mexico and they stay in the same hotel and she's putting the same seersucker suit on him and it becomes like vertigo for Talbots. And
it can't mean anything to you.
Exactly.
Just put your hair up. Ed Harris.
Yeah, you're bald.
Put your bald... I don't know.
So it's disappointing because it's got a good cast and it's got some good ideas, but it just gets ultimately dumb. So yeah,
Face Off,
the Face Off of Love. DVD recommendation:
Inside Llewyn Davis comes out this week.
Ah, okay.
Y'all watch that. It's real good. I really, really love that movie, and yeah, that's it. Go look at my review on movies.com. I'll tell you, that'll be 500 words of explanation that I don't need to give to you right now. Go give me a click. Go to movies.com, click on my face, scroll down, look at my review of Inside Llewyn Davis. That'll tell you everything you need to know about why you need to watch it on DVD.
My DVD pick this week is because I wanted to send people to a good Annette Bening movie, Finding Julia.
Which one is that?
That's the one where she's the aging actress. And she's got like the young ingenue.
I don't remember that one.
It was
she when did that come out?
Hang on, I'm pulling it up on IMDb. Is it Finding Julia? It was something Julia. It's one of those gerund movies.
Finding Julia's face on the body of another woman. That's the full title.
Hang on, that's not the... I've got the title of this movie wrong. I did not actually think of a
Eating Julia.
Give me 2 seconds. I'm going to figure this out. Being Julia. Being Julia, not Finding Julia. Sorry. Being Julia.
Is Being Julia?
It's set in England in the 1930s, and she is like...
What year?
2004. It was the second time that she was up against Hilary Swank for Best Actress.
I don't know that I remember that one.
It's really good. You should see it if you have not, or if you've forgotten
it. For all I know, I saw it and reviewed it. That's life.
You probably did, actually. Yeah. It's great. She's this aging stage actress. They're trying to kind of push her out of the way in favor of this ingenue, and she becomes very helpful and very supportive. Because why not?
Great.
Yeah, Being Julia, that's my DVD pick.
To whom it may concern, which I obviously hope is Alonzo and Dave, but I hate to be exclusionary. So everyone who wants to share the concern, this is for you too. I wanted to toss out a few questions that came to mind during your discussion of Son of God. Since I am not now, nor will I ever be the target audience for that film, I wanted to talk a bit more about the discussion that sprung from your contextualizing the movie. I'm curious about your general thoughts on what message first works do or don't do for film, / filmmakers. I mean, I think you touched on this a bit in the discussion, and in at least one previous podcast, where I remember Alonzo being annoyed by the idea that a filmmaker expected him to booster gay movies simply because they were gay movies. Those are in quotes.
Right.
He writes, apologies for the annoyance of scare quotes, but it's the best way I can think of to evoke a certain movie subcategory which wants to be but isn't really all-inclusive of films about gay experience.
I believe you mean faggy movies.
No, that's just 300.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. My own opinions tend to vacillate on this one. No matter what the message, I usually roll my eyes when interesting characters and good storytelling disintegrate or fail to exist at all. So that I can have a, you see, Timmy, moment full of important things we have to know.
I like that description.
You see, Timmy, it's obvious, and I kind of want to yell at the filmmakers to get the hell out of the movie I'm watching and write their essay so I can read it later and not in the middle of the story they're butchering in order to have someone spout it off. But when we have a poorly done movie with an obvious message with which we agree, do we want that to do well for commercial reasons? If the crappy gay movie does crappy box office, does it become harder to make a good movie about LGBTQ experience? Are we at risk of falling victim to all the stupid focus group logic that continues to insist films with element X will always bomb because other crappy films with similar surface elements did previously? Because part of me thinks that the message first stuff gets made because the people making it are so passionate about the message, and until the obvious stuff manages to break through some kind of commercial success barrier, it's unlikely that folks who aren't as passionate about it will have as much interest in making it, and then nothing changes. There's more.
Shall I continue?
This is a letter.
Okay, yeah.
I'm thinking here of what I remember about your Dallas Buyers Club podcast, where I think it was Alonzo talking about how annoying it was to get this movie propping up its straight hero for leading the way when he didn't. But if this was all we could get right now, then maybe it was a decent first step. I apologize if I'm misremembering or misconstrued your intent there, but even if you didn't say it, I imagine it's not an argument you're unfamiliar with. But then Twilight. Does commercial success for crappy material just net more crappy material? Now I have a headache. You wanted letters for cinema advice. There you go. Let's all lynch Joseph Heller for this one, shall we? Jason Kimball. Thank you, Jason Kimball. Then he writes, P.S. Could I request that you add your email address to the Linoleum Knife website?
It's not on the front page, but if you go to any individual page on the site, it's at the bottom of the page. But we'll try and put it on the homepage, too, since some people can't be bothered to click on anything.
all right.
Well, okay.
Jason.
I remember.
You write very thoughtful and long letters.
I've told this story before, probably, but I remember going to see in 1995.
1994, when life is nothing but special business.
No, 1995. Going to see a movie called Lie Down with Dogs.
Yep. You have told this story before.
Yeah, which was, in a nutshell, terrible gay movie. And at that point, there had been enough gay movies that I realized, you know, I don't have to see all of them. I don't have to support all of them. And I left.
You walked out?
I walked out because it was awful. And then I realized that at some point, you know, yes, you have to, when there's like two gay movies a year, you sort of have to give them the pity ticket purchase. But then when there's some...
The mercy hump.
When there's some competition, however, you can sort of say, no, I choose not to, you know. We were talking about, you know, last week when we were discussing Son of God, we're talking about movies who, even though we agree with the agenda, we still think it's a badly made film. And so I don't think that my dislike for fracking means that I have to let Promised Land off the hook for being a bad, preachy, unconvincing movie that happens to be anti-fracking.
Which one was that?
The one with Matt Damon and John Krasinski. One.
Yeah, that was...
That they wrote.
That was not so great.
That Gus Van Sant directed. Yeah.
Where's that dog coming from?
I don't know. I'm
Sounds
anti...
Sounds like we've got a dog in the apartment.
I'm anti that dog right now. No. I don't think that it's our responsibility to prop up certain kinds of movies strictly in order to get more of them made. I mean, I think there's a time for that sort of thing, but I don't know that. Like I said, and I think I'd say, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, when gay movies were so few and far between, then yes, that kind of thing maybe mattered. But nowadays, I don't know that it necessarily, if one of them doesn't do well, that kills all of them. I mean, granted, I will say on the other hand that it annoyed me when gay people were pooping all over Looking before it even started. Because they had these stupid complaints about, oh, it's not my exact life experience. And I just thought, you know what?
I thought I'd make some pooping noises
Thank
for you.
Thank you, yes. Yeah. I was like, you know, if you're going to be this negative about a gay show before it's even out of the gate, and it doesn't do well, when are they going to make the gay show that is reflective of your particular life story if this one flops.
Here's how that gay show would go if it were about me. Get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, make tea, have some toast. Enjoy programming my day in my at a glance with a sharpened number 2 pencil. Wash some dishes. Then think more about what I'm going to do in the day and have a second cup of tea. The first 45 minutes of my day have now been pretty fascinating for you, I know. There's so much more.
Tune in next week. So, yeah, I think that it's not, you know, that we should be able to demand good movies that also happen to be about subjects that we care about or you know, opinions that we agree with. The earlier part of the question was about, you know, movies that are sort of message first. And there are good ones. I mean, you can look at something like Salt of the Earth.
Well,
you know, there are films that are very much, they are about what they're about. And they're, you know, and yes. That kind of thing works better, I think, in documentary. But you can do it in a narrative. It's harder to do in a narrative. It's not impossible. But I'd say in the last few years, it's tends to be rather ham-fisted.
There's an anti-nuclear movie from the 80s called Testament.
Oh, God, yes.
That I really dig.
Wow.
Because everybody dies.
Oh, my God, that movie.
And they die slowly because they don't live near the thing.
Yeah. Just sort of lingering radiation.
The lingering radiation just slowly kills everyone.
God, there's this scene between Jane Alexander's the mother and I think Roxanne Azal, I forget who plays the daughter.
The daughter, yeah.
Where she's asking the mother, like, what sex is like.
Yeah.
You know, because it's clear that she's not going to live long enough to ever have.
And no one is, right.
Oh, my God. That movie is gutting. It's so good. It got some Oscar nominations.
It's a message film. Don't have a nuclear bomb is the message of that movie.
You know,
if you have one, don't explode it.
A Face in the Crowd, which Dave and I were talking about earlier, is a great movie about, you know, media manipulation and about demagoguery. But it's also, you know, a good story about interesting characters. So, you know, you can do both.
Yeah.
What else?
It just didn't happen with Son of God.
Exactly.
At all. Here's another Son of God letter. Hey, Dave and Alonzo. I recorded and watched some of that Bible miniseries on TV, just for snits, and giggles. It did not disappoint. I got as far as the Sodom and Gomorrah story and had to quit because the production values were so bad. One of the angels does sword kung fu to fight his way out of the city. The fight scenes weren't even Hercules or Xena good. I just shook my head, barely chuckled, and deleted the rest of the series. So, yeah. There was no name on that letter.
I believe there was, and you just erased it.
It may have been Robbie.
No, it was not Robbie. Hold on. I will tell you.
Are you going to pause while you look it up?
No, I haven't.
We're just going to vamp here. I'm doing this to shame you, really.
All
right, yeah, sure. Do it.
Matthew. That was from Matthew.
I see. Okay.
Thank you, Matthew, for your letter, and also the writer of the other one, which I don't have in front of me anymore.
All right.
We've really got to get this working better.
We've got a top 10 list from Kevin.
Okay.
Kevin Schoberg. And here it is. Hang on. Gentlemen, I would like to take some liberty. You can't. There you go. We're against liberty at this podcast. And especially anyone who is not us. The liberty of all the people who are not us. He would like to take some liberty with his top 10 list.
Okay.
And he would like to submit, to be knifed, his firsts list.
Mm-hmm.
First things regarding film. Number one, the first movie he ever saw in a theater, Mary Poppins. He says, breaking into song on film still excites me. His first art house film was Jean Cocteau's La Belle et la Bête. His first gay movie. So we think this is a gay, or maybe just someone who just saw his first gay movie.
Mm.
His first gay movie was Making Love Oh, he says, I was just coming up. So this is a gay.
Oh, okay.
Kevin's a gay. And it helped me think everything was going to be okay.
Well, all right.
That he was going to hook up with Michael Ontkean.
We all thought that.
Or maybe he was a Harry Hamlin guy.
Who knows?
I was not.
Michael Ontkean?
Well, yeah, because, you know, him, that, and the Rookies and Twin Peaks. I thought he was kind of dreamy.
True, yeah. Harry Hamlin is attractive, but he's, you know.
He has a more severe sort of face.
He's lippy.
He's got that kind of like face. If you think Alain Delon is like the most beautiful man in the world, then you're kind of a Harry Hamlin kind of guy.
Yeah, Harry Hamlin is sort of like the guys who did the English Leather magazine ads.
Handsome, but they look mean. Like they might say mean things to you all the time. Michael Ontkean, he would never say mean things to you.
He's sweet. Go on.
First silent movie, Metropolis. First saw it at the Walker Art Museum, and then later on the big screen with the Pat Benatar, Giorgio Moroder soundtrack, which amazingly only made it better.
It does. That version gets a bad rap. I'm hoping
that version is dope. Version is so good.
Now that it's been reissued on Blu-ray, I hope people take it more seriously.
Giorgio Moroder Metropolis is so great.
It is. Yeah. And also, when I saw it, it was the first time that I had seen a more restored Metropolis. Yes. Like, there's an even more restored one now. But it put in a lot of, like, linking material that made things make sense. So like, oh, okay. You know, so yeah, that's that movie does not get its due. Go on.
First movie that made me think, WTF. What the F? Eraserhead.
Mm.
Six, first drive-in movie that I drove to. The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Wow, you're old.
Apparently. I think it was good, but I was busy getting busy, if you catch what I'm doing. Well, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly is a good movie to do that to because it's real long. Yeah. First movie I ever went to paying with my own money from my paper route to Sir with Love.
Wow.
So you're a baby boomer.
Yes.
Yeah. I irritated all for the next week by speaking only with my newly acquired Lulu accent.
Bloody Lulu.
First horror movie, Night of the Living Dead.
These are good ones.
First documentary, Roger and Me. You waited a long time to watch a documentary, buddy.
That's like, what, 1989?
Yeah.
1990, I think it was a good one.
Sometimes it takes a while to get to a documentary.
You know, you could have totally seen Grey Gardens. You were old enough for that.
Yep.
All right, anyway,
First NC-17 movie I saw, Caligula.
Well,
it nearly turned me off to sex completely.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, yes, although NC-17 didn't exist when Caligula came out, I'll allow it.
Well, but it was...
He means X.
X, yeah. Thanks for the podcast. You're welcome, Kevin.
You're welcome, Kevin.
Been a steady listener for a long time. Dave White, please write a follow-up book that I will pay full price for. Because I got your first book at a used bookstore for $2.25, and I feel I owe you. Well, you do. And that book is coming. It just, boy, is it taking a long time. The end. End of podcast.
We have to knife him.
Oh, that's 100%.
That's 100%.
Yeah, that's okay. Full on 100%. You're all the knives. you're 10 vintage knives, 100%.
So, as always, we thank you for listening. Just a reminder, our awesome new DVD commentary for Clue is available.
Buy that thing.
It's $1.99.
$1.99.
All you have to do is PayPal us at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. We will send you the link. Visit our website, linoleum-knife.com, which we occasionally update with things. And while you're on the internet and looking at the URLs, go visit ChristyLemire.com. If you are a serious XM listener, check out Rotten Tomatoes Radio with Gray Drake and Matt Atchity every Tuesday and Thursday. Also tune into the Frank DeCaro Show. I was just on this week with Jackie Beat talking about the Oscars. And check out the Derek and Romaine Show, which Dave and I are occasionally
featured
upon. And out there in podcast land, check out Fat Guys of the Movies, the Criterion Cast, the Team Jack Podcast, Schmoes, the Schmoes Know, The B-Movies Podcast, Film Spotting SVU, Podcrash, Game Night Guys, Secretly Timid, and The Lunch. You can subscribe to the show for free on iTunes, and if you want to leave us a review there, that would be great. You can stream the show at Stitcher Radio or TheLounge.com or on our Facebook page, and while you're there, give us a like. You can follow us on Twitter at LinoleumCast. Follow me on Twitter at A Duralde, A-D-U-R-A-L-D-E. You can follow Dave at D Leland White. You can check into the show at tvtag.com and drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com with questions, comments, top 10 lists, worst 10 lists, whatever else.
I want a key lime cake. You could send me a key lime cake.
But by
it's
all
one
means,
of Oprah's favorite things. Well, one of her former favorite things.
Would be reform
like when she had favorite things. Oh, remember how she used to do
yeah.
that?
Yeah.
One of them was this key lime cake.
I see.
I've always wanted to have it.
so yeah, check out our Clue commentary. You can still get.
I was thinking about that. I'm always thinking about cake.
You are.
Specifically this morning, I woke up and I was thinking about the key lime cake, and I thought, when do I get to have that?
You should probably learn to make one.
I'm gonna buy one.
You can get our
have it shipped in the mail.
You can get our commentary for Clue. You can get our commentary for the Apple. Do we want to tell them what March is yet or no?
Not yet.
Okay, we're working on this month's commentary.
It's going to be real good, and it's probably something you've never seen before.
Yeah, so that'll be new. And
until then, you know, you watch the Apple and you watch Clue, mm-hmm. and then you buy the commentaries. You buy the Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife extra episode that costs you $1.99 each. Because you've got $3.98.
You just do.
And you're going to give it to us. That's just how it's going to be. Think about it like this. If you're too cheap to give me a key lime cake, you could give me $3.98 for those two commentaries. Or $1.99 for one of the commentaries, whichever one you haven't already purchased. There's a lot of you that haven't purchased them.
Yes.
A lot of you.
Get on it.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Spend. It goes to a good cause.
Key lime cakes.
Key lime cakes.
We'll catch you next time.
Goodbye.